Welcome to the RPGBot.podcast. I'm Randall James, your TPKing Taskmaster, and with me is Tyler Kamstra.
Hi, everybody.
And Ash Eli.
Hey, guys.
All right, Tyler, what has happened?
Tonight, we're going to talk about tactics for dungeon masters and basically how to run monsters in a way that is both intelligent and, you know, manageable for the DM or GM. I've played with a lot of different people, a lot of different game masters and dungeon masters, and one of the frequent problems that I see is when combat starts, the DM GM looks at the enemies and says, okay, which of the players do I punch in the mouth? And very frequently, it's difficult to make that decision because you're handed, like, here's your stat block. The encounter is three goblins by the side of a road. Good luck. So we're going to go into some advice tonight about how to handle that situation, how you can make those decisions in a way that makes sense.
Yeah, I can say definitely for me as a DMGM, I am finally coming out of the shell. Like, initially, the way that I ran combat was I'm either going to strategically heckle the party because I, as the DM, know what's bad for the party, or I'm specifically not going to do that because I know what's bad for the party. And every fight is going to be a fight to the death for my creatures. And realistically, that's not the most interesting way to run combat. And if you begin to think a little bit more nuanced, and I think a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight is essentially the creature itself has a motivation. The creature has a way of thinking about how this combat is going to go. And if you can add that layer in about, well, not what do I know as the DMGM, what does the creature know about the party that they're facing? And how would this creature face it? And ultimately, that decision tree doesn't have to get too crazy. I think we can actually do a pretty good job of putting together something that will make combat more interesting.
Agreed.
So let's talk a little bit about the creatures that are going to be in your encounters. So we're going to call back to our episode with Keith Allman a while back. Keith writes the blog, The Monsters Know What They're Doing, and his books based on the blog are excellent. Strongly recommend them. So borrowing from the first section of the original The Monsters Know What They're Doing book, the section is called Why These Tactics, and it's very useful. So we're going to borrow some things which explain how Keith handles things based on the intelligence and wisdom of the creatures, and we're going to simplify this a little bit. So you can consider intelligence as the creature's ability to make tactical decisions and wisdom as their ability to make survival decisions. Keith gives a much more specific explanation for each value, but low intelligence creatures generally will have very, very simple tactics. They'll generally have like one thing that they do in combat. So that's like dogs, zombies, like one intelligence creatures like violet fungus, which are just a stimulus response thing. So they have one thing that they do in a fight, and if that doesn't work, they literally don't know what else to do. So they'll either do that or run away.
They do it again, and then they do it again.
Yeah. Yes. Middle intelligence is like your typical humans, maybe dumb humans. So smarter than animal intelligence, these will generally be creatures that are smart enough to speak a language, but definitely not geniuses by any means. So most of them will have unsophisticated tactics. They'll be capable of making minor adjustments on the fly, but generally it's still going to be like, I am the town guard. I have 10 or 11 intelligence and I have a spear. My go-to tactic is poke things with the spear. If I absolutely need to, I can throw the spear, but I really don't want to have to do that because I only have one spear.
Should have carried javelins.
There you go.
But I mean, the resources, right? The taxes haven't been what they used to be. Like, ultimately, the department couldn't cost it. So here I am with one spear against this party.
I'm just George with a spear. My name is George and I have a spear, but I think related to that, you also have to think about mob intelligence. Like a group of just an angry mob of villagers is going to have very different tactics from well-trained guards.
Absolutely.
Disorganized militia.
None of us are as dumb as all of us.
Exactly. There's going to be some who are smart, some who are dumb, and
collectively, like, who's very stupid? Us.
Yeah, so maybe take average intelligence of the group, if you're doing this method. Average intelligence, like if there's a bunch of smart people, but there's also a lot of dumb people, It's going to be hard to organize.
So speaking of smart people, high intelligence creatures. So those are the ones that are going to start making increasingly effective tactical decisions. So like as you get further up the intelligence scale, you might make decisions based on like, okay, we have multiple tools available to us. How can we potentially apply them? Like, okay, more intelligent. Our opponents have some weaknesses. How can we capitalize on those weaknesses? So like if you're facing some high intelligence enemies and the players have a couple party members who are seriously injured, rather than just charging the first enemy that they can reach, intelligent enemies might be like, I'm going to take pot shots at the dude in the back who's clearly on his last legs.
The wizard looks squishy. Get him.
Yes. So jumping over to wisdom, which again is the creature's ability to assess survival decisions. Low wisdom creatures, surprisingly, there aren't a ton of them in D&D 5e. Like things with very, very low wisdom tend to be things like zombies, skeletons, plant creatures, basically things that they're barely intelligent. There are animals like kippers, for example, have one intelligence and like eight wisdom, so they're still in that like middle wisdom range, but they're still basically just a stimulus response machine. But things with very low wisdom generally have poor survival instincts and don't know to run away until it's too late, if they know to run away at all.
And I think you can make the argument that because we're calling wisdom this like survival stat, if you started life with very low wisdom, you're not going to make it to the point of fighting the adventurers. You're going to die along the way.
Probably, yes.
Your zombies and skeletons, they're dead now.
So that middle wisdom range is, you know, typical human wisdom. So think of yourself as a person. Most of us aren't very good at assessing, like, can I take this person in a fight? Like, do I know what to look for in a fight? And keep in mind, today's human beings, we've got, you know, a century of like film media and books and stuff to look at. And we can be like, ah, yes, I have seen a bodybuilder. I know what a very muscly person looks like. And I know that I probably don't want to fight that person. But like, if you're podunk farmer from fantasy land, like you've never seen an adventurer come through, and you see some person being a jerk in a bar, you might be like, yeah, I'm gonna throw a punch at this guy. I've got 10 wisdom. I have no exposure to anything that would tell me that this could be a problem, so I'm gonna make some poor choices.
But then the first time they land a punch, you're really like, nope, nope, no, this was a mistake. I'm gonna apologize, good sir. I'm gonna buy you a whole bottle of whiskey, and then I'm going to run away.
Yes.
If we're going by this system where, you know, middle of the road, pretty typical human survival instincts, it is interesting, and I just looked this up, that golems have 11 wisdom.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. So they'll have, like, they'll have pretty typical survival instincts, but golems also act based on orders from their masters. So, like, the golem might very well be like, I'm losing this fight. I know I'm going to die, but here I am.
I mean, maybe it comes down to the fact that are they immune to fear? Let me see. No, they're not. Interesting.
That is interesting.
But I do think, and we're going
to
get in.
They are immune to fear.
Okay, good.
Okay. The world is right then. Yeah, I mean, we're going to get into this in a second, but I think at a high level, I really like this idea of using int wisdom to kind of pick, like, well, how tactically am I going to let this creature think? I'm going to argue, like, survival tactics. How much of their own survival am I going to allow this creature to consider? I think there's another dimension of this that we're going to hop into a bit. And I think the golem's a fantastic example of, like, okay, we have to consider more than just these base stats.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This is, like, a great baseline to start from, but, like, not super precise. And I'm sure all of Keith's tactical entries are way more specific than this, but this does give you a great baseline to start from.
100%.
So just to hit on high wisdom real quick, and then we'll move on. High wisdom creatures are generally much better at assessing a threat level. It's like, if you are very wise, you probably know, like, hey, I realize that bison are herbivores, but they're also like a 3-ton animal. I'm not going to approach a bison because it could step on me and kill me.
Yeah. Also hippos. Stay away from hippos. They'll kill you.
Yeah.
And Tarrasques.
Tarrasques. Famously fluffy Tarrasques. Yes, don't pet them.
not herbivores, though. Let's be very clear. They're euivores. They'll eat you.
I love it. I'm using that from now on.
Yeah, so like we said, that gives you a great baseline. One of the things that I personally would use to adjust these up and down is like the weapon proficiencies of a creature. If a creature is proficient in weapons of some kind, it has had some form of training to learn how to use those weapons, which might influence its abilities to think about combat. So if a creature is proficient in martial weapons, they're probably trained in like some basic tactics stuff. They are probably trained like, hey, know your limits. Don't go fighting dragons by yourself. So you might treat them as like one step higher on that intelligence and wisdom scale. So like wizards, famously the only class in 5e that isn't at least proficient in simple weapons, despite being extremely intelligent, they're probably not super great at actual combat tactics. So like a wizard who spent their entire life in a library comes out, it's like, I'm going to be tactics general guy. Yeah, probably doesn't make a lot of sense based on their training.
Awesome. So we're talking about wisdom as like the survival statistic. I wanted to bring up, so we've talked before on the podcast about Merkborg. Merkborg actually has a wonderful system for capturing the same thing that we're talking about applying wisdom to, and that's the morale system. So the idea is most creatures have a morale number, and there's a list of events that could happen. A GM, of course, could always adjust to this. So let's say there's a group of enemy creatures and the leader dies. That's going to cause a morale check. If half the group has been killed, that's going to cause a morale check. And if you think about it, that's logical, right? There were four of us. Now there's two of us. I don't know if we're going to make it. Let's see how I'm doing. How high is my morale? And then finally, if the lone remaining or single enemy drops below a third HP, like I'm really taking a beating right now. I know I'm hurt. I might need to step away from this. You do the morale check. You roll 2d6. If what you roll is higher than that creature's morale number, roll another d6. 1 through 3, creature flees. 4 through 6, the creature surrenders. And then in Merkborg, there's a system for basically like you can take either dead or captured enemies and actually sell them. So it's a way of making money, you know, built into it. I don't know that we need to take that into D&D, but I do think this idea of morale, looking at wisdom and doing a dice roll to make the decision like, okay, this is a creature which understands its life is in peril and values that life. I might use a dice roll to make the decision ultimately of, do they run away? Do they yield and try to parlay like, hey, let's not do this. I'd rather not die right now. Or do they keep fighting? So using this as a guide, but adding a bit of randomness so that your party, you know, if you're fighting a lot of humans or humanoids, your party isn't constant. It's like, okay, we've got 30 people in cuffs behind us. I can't take any more prisoners right now. I'm sorry.
That I love that. And I'm wondering if there's a way that we can translate it to D&D. I know that the DMG does have optional rules for morale, but it's like a bar that like depletes. It's like morale damage, but maybe something like a wisdom saving throw that goes up for every one of these things that happens. It stacks and it gets every creature that goes down adds to the DC to the pass or something. I don't know, just spitballing.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. I can't remember the specific text of the morale variant, but yeah, definitely go check on that. You could also factor in other stuff about the creature. Like you could call that a wisdom save against fear. So if the creature is resistant to fear, they're more likely to stick it out when things are going well. If they're immune to fear, like they might be zealous like a paladin and like, no, I'm going to stand my ground and fight this out no matter what. So like you can still factor in the creature's stats into that concept of a morale check, but the morale check does give you a plausible, like somewhat reasonable answer for when a creature or group of creatures should turn tail and run.
Yeah.
And yeah, borrowing the Merkborg option of like basically 50-50 chance, do they run away, do they surrender? That works fine unless you have some good reason why they would take some other option. Like if they're backed into a corner and there's nowhere to run, they're going to surrender. If they've got allies around the corner, they're going to run.
Yeah, and I think, so you're talking about having allies behind the corner, the circumstances of the combat, I think really do need to influence both how they're going to think tactically as well as how they think about their own survival instinct. So I wanted to run through, like, what are some of the reasons that the creatures we fight in tabletop games fight? The simplest-minded creatures fight for food or other resources, right? Most predators are looking for easy targets. You know, we've talked about this in the past. If I have a black bear in the Mirani Forest, if they realize that their tuna is still canned, they're probably going to take off. They're not going to stay around for that combat because they're wise enough to want to preserve themselves. But if I'm in Tin Towns and we're essentially in our own little mini apocalypse and there's no food anywhere, that polar bear is probably going to fight me to death because I'm the first food it's seen in weeks. You know, the circumstances are ultimately going to drive what that creature is going to do.
Yeah, polar bears are a great example. Even real-world polar bears, if they find food, they will 100% go after that food, including humans a lot of times, because they live in an environment where food is so scarce that if they see food, they basically don't have a choice. They might not see more food for a while, so they've got to go after it.
Yeah, what's the saying? Black, you fight. Brown, play dead. White, say goodnight. Sort of. I don't know if you guys have heard that.
Black fight back, brown lay down, white say goodnight. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is it. I've got a joke that involves bells, but we'll save that for after the show.
So one of the other reasons that creatures fight is to protect their lives or to protect their families. Their families' lives. In our villain episode, we talked about, the party killing the baker and his son. So maybe the baker tries to fight them off to protect his son, fails, and now the son is taking revenge for his family.
Yeah, Bradley. Bradley's going to get us all.
Yeah, Bradley is going to kill everybody.
No, but I mean, there's a real desperation, right? Like, if you're in those circumstances... if it's literally like whether it's my home or whether it's my keep that I live in, if I'm fighting knowing that everybody I care about is going to die if I fail, I'm going to fight extra hard. I'm going to fight with inspiration because it's not just my life. It's the people that I love. And so this is a person that might have extremely high intelligence, might have extremely high wisdom. And wisdom is really what we're talking about here. That high wisdom doesn't automatically translate to running away, because ultimately they want to protect the people around them. But I'll also say a person in this situation might be willing to believe a sincere offer of truce. And if you roll a high enough deception, they might fall for a lie that says that you're going to let them be.
Yeah.
A really good example here, kobolds. So canonically throughout D&D history, kobolds aren't super strong. They typically have... poor armaments, and they're generally bullied by larger creatures like dragons. So they will rely on traps to defend themselves as much as possible, because generally kobolds won't win in a stand-up fight. If the traps don't do the trick, the warriors will basically throw themselves at their opponents to buy time for everybody else to escape, because they make that, like, we've got passable wisdom, we're going to make that calculation, like, some of us can die, or all of us can die, so I guess we're going to go for some of us. But kobolds will very, very quickly surrender if it makes sense, and they will happily take a chance to negotiate.
Oh my god, that's so sad. So you're telling me that we've been killing a bunch of just poor kobolds who are just trying to defend themselves and buy time for their families to get out from these horrible, horrible adventurers.
Yeah, but they, like, stole my potatoes, man.
And look, they're working for this white dragon that just keeps, eating potatoes, I guess.
They're working for the dragon because he's protecting them, man. They don't have a lot of options.
Obviously not, because I just walked straight into this cave, straight through the traps, and was fighting kobold warriors. Where's the dragon now?
Surprise, the kobolds were protecting the dragon.
It did not work out. Did not work out.
Yeah, it's not always fun to be a CR0 humanoid in D&D.
Yeah, it's usually not. And so talking about that relationship, right, like dragon to kobold, sometimes you are henchmen working for pay. In society, we call them guards, but it's still the same situation, right? What I'll call out, oftentimes, if you are getting paid, that means that you are intelligent enough to understand currency. If you are smart enough to understand currency, you are probably also smart, or you are wise enough to understand currency is not worth dying for. I think tactically, these are the humanoids, when given the opportunity, that need to just run away. And I think as a DMGM in the past, I failed in this situation. But 100%, like, we're fighting in a hallway and the first person falls. If I'm the other guard, I'm out of here. I'm screaming, like, let's get help, because I think there's enough people in the building to take care of this. But I am not going to die so you can't get into the treasury. That's all I'm saying.
There's also bribery, which could be a thing. So it's like, hey, I'll give you a ton of money if you just leave. Deal.
Yeah, just make them a better offer. Like offering them their lives very frequently works. Offering them money very frequently works. Yeah, if you're willing to be bought to work for one side, it's generally pretty easy to buy you to work for the other side.
Okay, what's funny to me about this, we always talk about how gold is worthless in 5e, right? At the same time, I can imagine every party that I've ever DM'd for would 100% look at that situation where you're like, how much gold do we have? 300 gold? I'm not giving him one. No.
It's the principle.
Why would we pay him if we could just kill him?
And the guards, again, wise creatures, if you're the guard and you're listening to this conversation amongst the players, begin backing slowly out of the room because you don't need to be there anymore.
Yep. Another reason people fight is for loyalty to a leader, either for love of their leader or more often fear of their leader.
Or magic control. I don't want to bring that in. Like, you brought up the golem example.
Yeah, that is another scenario. Recently, actually, my party is fighting. They returned to one of the party members' homeland that's been taken over by this dictator, and they've been fighting servants of that dictator. And they tried to intimidate them into surrendering and stuff, but intimidation checks didn't work because they were way more scared of the leader than of the party. And so you can sometimes use that, like, decide who they're more scared of in that moment. Are they more scared of the party than the immediate death, or their lord and maybe a later death or something worse?
I love that. Like, it's almost an idea of adding like a passive, not intimidated score.
Yeah.
Like, your intimidation needs to cross like 26 before I'm going to cross the antagonist that's waiting for me behind me.
Yeah. It's like, you don't understand. She will turn my body inside out and I will become a thrall and still be conscious the entire time for the rest of eternity, however long she lives. I would rather you kill me. Wait,
what, you were just going to stab me? Like, straight, clean through? That, yeah.
Let's right party. Here. Right here. This is where my heart is. Please do it.
anybody got a pin? Just draw a circle. Don't actually pantomime guards like that, though. That's landing up. At that point, the party's going to be like, this is a trap. We have to get out of here. If anything, that's a brilliant tactic, actually. Yeah. The guard who wants to die too much.
Just stall for time by asking politely to be killed in a way that the players won't actually follow through with. That may take longer than combat, considering combat takes like 20 seconds tops. You know, 6 second rounds, 3 round combat.
Okay, yeah. You meant in game. I thought you meant in real life, and I'm like, what combat are you having? Look, there's the guide to quick combat. It's not that fast.
It's not that fast. It is not 20 seconds.
but if you haven't read the guide to quick combat, we'll have a link in the show notes.
It's good. Yeah. Another reason that a creature might fight is just because they enjoy it. There are creatures who just enjoy acts of violence. Fiends in D&D are a great example.
Vikings,
depending on how the Vikings are portrayed. Yeah. like honorable combat, yada yada, or maybe they're just hyper violent for whatever reason. In the Forgotten Realms, like Menzoberranzan and Drow really enjoy hunting intelligent creatures, so they'll like capture creatures, set them loose, hunt them down with sleep poison, be like, ah, I put it to sleep, I won, I'm gonna take it back and we'll do this again tomorrow. Like, okay. Oof, that's evil.
Yeah, there's also certain cultures that just glorify combat and stuff, and those can be really dangerous enemies to fight against because they want to die in battle. They don't want to be taken prisoner. They don't want to surrender. They don't want to flee because that's an act of cowardice and hide against their honor. So they will fight to the death, and those can be extremely dangerous. Especially if you're not having every creature fight to the death, that can really spell out to your party member, to your party members, that, oh, this guy means business and he's not running away. He wants to die. This is going to be rough.
Yeah, I really feel like this is two sides of the same coin. So we could talk about pleasure and we could talk about pride. And then there's kind of a tree here. So the fighting for pleasure is the person who inflicts violence for themselves. Fighting for pride is a person who inflicts pain and violence for society, like for those around them. It has to be known that they're doing this, or when called out, when somebody says, like, well, you're not that bad, or, you know, I challenge you to a duel, the person who accepts, maybe even begrudgingly, but they can't accept the shame of not going through with it. And ultimately, I feel like the result is the same, right? For certain groups of people, these folks, whether it be for pleasure or pride, are dangerous when winning and likely to be cowardly when they recognize they're likely to lose, because they're still wise enough to know, I would rather not have this pleasure, or I would rather suffer shame than die.
They're sort of like predators of pain. They would rather find the easy game that they can exploit and win and get that pleasure out of it, rather than something that can actually pose a threat to them.
100%. They're hungry for satisfaction.
Yeah.
And if they recognize they're not going to get it, but we can take this a step further, right? And I think, Ash, you were calling this out perfectly a little bit ago. There are going to be some of these people who the thrill of potentially losing feeds into their pleasure, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What was the gambling movie? I want to say... Two for the money. Okay. Al Pacino, right? He gives this great speech where he goes to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting and he's talking to them about, like, you know, we don't feel alive every day. We feel alive, you know, what we do, we put it all on the line and then we lose and we have nothing. And we wake up and we've never felt more alive. Like, he gives that whole speech and you're like, that's terrifying. And some people are sitting home, it's like, no, I've totally had that feeling, right? Like, the loss is the thing that drives you. And these people who are super dangerous, the fact that, like, you have them near death and they're still fighting it out, they have survived that so many times that at this point, it's just part of the pleasure for them.
There's also a pretty common trope of the warrior who's so good that nothing really poses a threat to him anymore. And so he gets bored with combat. So when he finds someone that actually can hurt him and give him a challenge, he's like, finally, a worthy opponent. Yes. We will have many glorious battles.
Oh, man, so I'm a big fan of Brandon Sanderson in
Mistborn, Stormlight Archive.
In Stormlight Archives, there's a character, Zeth, who, like, in the beginning, you're introduced as an assassin. And the punchline for this character is they have to act as a servant to, you know, whoever controls them at the time. And the one thing they're not allowed to do is take direct steps to lead to their death. But if ordered into combat, if they were to die by the natural skill of the person they're in combat with, allowed to die. And so this character is a perfect example of this, where the character wants to die. The character is miserable. The character has been miserable for years, but can't die because the character has not faced anybody strong enough to kill him. And then similarly on the pride, right? We talked about a second ago that for many characters, when they realize their life is on the line, they will take shame. They'll live with shame. But there are some characters who will not live with that shame and would rather die than face it. And these are the most dangerous for your party to be fighting.
100%.
So we've talked a lot about, like, why a creature fights, like how they'll handle making survival decisions, running away or not running away. So let's talk about, like, attacking, like, you know, the reason why we're here. How do we decide, as a DM or GM, how do we decide which of these players I'm going to punch in the face? Because that is the hard decision that you as the DM or GM are going to have to make. So prioritizing targets is, to put it lightly, it's difficult. You need to have some sort of insight into your creature. And like we've talked about, why they fight, their intelligence, their wisdom, like what tactics they're going to use based on their stats, based on their training, based on what we know of them and their culture. But you need to make all of those decisions very, very quickly, unless you've had plenty of time to think about it and read the monsters, know what they're doing. So when you're making these snap decisions quickly, how do we make those choices for who to attack? Generally, the easiest decision is just go to predator logic, go for the one that looks the most frail. In a lot of cases, like, that is the easiest thing that any creature can do. Like, I'm a goblin sitting on the side of a road. I have a short bow, and I'm going to get one shot at these guys before they start shooting back. And I see, like, okay, that guy's wearing full plate armor. That dude's wearing a bathrobe. I'm going to shoot Mr. Bathrobe. Which brings us to the tank fallacy real fast. Players, if your character is completely untouchable in combat, cannot be hurt, the enemies will not attack you. They will kill all of your friends. Tank fallacy. Yes.
And I would say, as a part of that, DMs don't feed into the tank fallacy. I know it's tempting to just be like, I'll just have these guys wail on the tank so that it's not as much of a threat. That's not satisfying. Make the tank work for being the tank. Like, if they want to tie down people and protect their friends, have them take the sentinel feat. Have them cut off their means past them. Stuff like that.
So a classic problem that I always have is when I'm running monsters, like you're running high intelligence casters or like several thousand year old demon lords or whatever, a lot of the monsters are smarter than me. Mm-hmm. So
I would imagine a lot. No, I'm just kidding.
yes. Like, when you're looking at creatures, like, this thing has 30 intelligence. Humans max out at 20. There's no possible way I'm as smart as this thing. How do I run it? You can do two things to help yourself. One, you can plan ahead, because you're simulating a super intelligent creature making moment-to-moment decisions, which realistically, if you're pretending to be something smarter than you, you can't do that. So plan ahead. Make the decisions when you have the comfort of time. And two, you can cheat. You as the DM or GM know a lot about your players, and you can say, oh yes, this creature's got 30 intelligence and 30 wisdom. They're omniscient and know all things, especially about the players. So they are reasonably going to use that knowledge. Like, they know, oh, yes, the wizard is going to walk into this fight concentrating on an important spell. So I'm going to hit the wizard. I'm going to watch out for the rogue walking up behind me. I'm going to fly above the fighter because the fighter can't fly. And then you've leveraged that creature's, like, all of their stats in a way that makes sense for that creature. Yeah, just by thinking ahead a little bit.
Yeah, Crit Fails, actually, we actually talked about this on Crit Fails, about how do you play a character that has above a 20 intelligence, superhuman intelligence, essentially. And I think that there are ways that you can just do it. Like, you can cheat and add some new mechanics. Like, maybe when the players do with something, you can roll a die and be like, oh, they have a contingency for this. They knew that you were going to do this, and they have an answer for it. Sort of like how the contingency spell works for wizards, and be like, oh yeah, they just so happened to you shot that arrow exactly where they thought that it would, and the timer went off for them, and the wall came up to block the arrow, something like that. sort of a Moriarty type of situation. It's
a real Goldberg dungeon you designed there, but
yeah, you know, I that's just an example that I came up off the top of my head. But essentially, it's just like, if you're playing prescient characters or characters who are incredibly more intelligent than you could even possibly conceive, then give them mechanics to sort of match that. That would be my best recommendation, but I wouldn't abuse it, because then your players will probably start to get angry at you.
Well, let's recognize if we're fighting something with this high of intelligence, it is probably a central antagonist.
Yes.
So this is a place where you can bring in layer actions, legendary actions, and henchmen to help support the things that you're trying to achieve. Where kind of the plausible deniability after the story, it's like, whoa, you know, how do you know to put their person here and engage me? It's like, well, you know, they thought about it and he drew up a plan on the blackboard and back. He was like, you know, they were getting ready to go out and make a play. And so everybody there was very well trained, or they had the mind control. I don't need either one. You take it. But then kind of flipping that on its head, you know, talking about the monsters are smarter than the DM. This almost is the way that we, I feel like I want to invoke the wrong way that I talked about DMing up front, which is kind of skipping straight to, I am the omniscient DM who knows everything that's happening. This is actually the place where it makes sense to leverage everything that you know, which is exactly what Tyler was getting at.
Yeah, and those intelligent creatures really should be the ones that scare your players. Like the dumb things that are big and strong, like their tactics will be simple. The players can very frequently overcome them just by force. Those intelligence creatures, you want to try and make their decisions like tactical and scary. Make them scared. A very, very heavily optimized character will not save you if you as a player are not clever enough to match the creatures that you're facing. Like if your strategy in every combat is tank up front, everybody else in the back, just slinging damage downrange, that's going to work until it doesn't. And if you can't adapt, you're going to die no matter how good your character is.
This kind of feeds into something else that we want to talk about, which is when a party member goes down, do you still kill them? Like, do you still attack them? I know that we as DMs don't want to do that. Like, if a party member is unconscious, we're like, okay, we're going to move on to another one. But Matt Koval, I think, made a great point. If a villain wants to get rid of the party, when the party member goes down, they're going to finish them off. I don't know if you guys agree or not, but it's an iffy topic.
I think it depends on the scenario and the villain, right? I want to roll this back. Let's not talk about villains yet. Let's talk about general creatures. Even medium intelligent, let's say I'm fighting average intelligence humanoids. When a player character goes down, that person is likely to focus on the next up player character to get them down, because the goal is to get the entire party down, and then we'll go along and we'll kill them after.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
For sure.
The first time as that average intelligence, I see that creature get up, whether it be that somebody, you know, healed them, somebody gave them a healing potion. If anything happens and I see one get up, the next time one goes down, I'm killing them because I'm not going to deal with this again.
Yeah, and that's a great counter to that classic health ping pong thing in 5e where the tank goes down, gets up, goes down, gets up. It's like, no, everything's going to focus on that guy so they don't get back up and doesn't cause more problems. A lot of this will come down to like what the creature is, their personality. Like ghouls, 7 intelligence, like just at that very top range of animal intelligence. Middling wisdom. Ghouls are cannibalistic undead that eat living flesh. So their whole thing is like, I'm going to knock something down, ideally paralyze it, and then I'm going to eat it. And as a ghoul, if they bring somebody down, sure, maybe there's other creatures in the room fighting, but they're like, no, I've got food right here. I'm going to do this.
If nobody's doing me direct harm, I'm going to have a snack.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Other creatures might not work that way, but yeah, consider what the creature is.
I think that makes perfect sense. And then, Ash, towards your point a second ago, with like the BBG type villains, if as an antagonist, their goal is literally to kill the party, if it's, you know, some vengeance they're seeking, if the party has become such a thorn that the party has to be gone, I think I 100% agree with Matt Koval's idea, right? That we're now one of them goes down, let's finish them off. And congratulations, you get to try something new, player.
Yeah.
But if the villain is more trying to achieve something and they're barely aware the party exists because they're only just now coming into the fold, I think that's a situation where a villain might not try to finish that off, but instead is like, okay, I just need to get rid of all of you, so I'm just going to start doing damage because my expectation is I'm probably going to win.
Yeah. And even if they don't think they're going to win, and they bring down one of the players, maybe that becomes a win condition for them. They're like, okay, this fight isn't going great for me, but I've got this. I've got one player down. We're going to parley.
Yeah.
having an intelligent creature threaten to execute a dying player is a very easy way to, like, turn combat in the enemy's favor.
Excuse me, friends. I have a legendary action and a magic missile primed. Would you like to talk?
Oh, God. Magic missile, the instant player killer.
Yep.
So let's talk about how we do this with multiple enemies, because a lot of encounters in 5th edition, you're going to have multiple creatures in the encounter with different stat blocks. The single enemy encounter is much less of a thing in 5e than it was in like 3x. So sure, there'll be encounters where it's like three orcs. They're all basically the same intelligence. They'll work kind of the same way, whatever. In some encounters, you will have enemies that have different stats, use different stat blocks. Randall, you and me just played through the Right to Arm Bugbears from our friends at AAW Games, and all of those encounters had like two or three different enemies in them with different stats, different motivations, different tactics.
Yeah, I mean, to give a specific example, so at one point we were fighting, I think they were Hobgoblin casters. There was like a Beastmaster Ranger type Hobgoblin or Orc, and then there were Panthers. And so the idea was tactically that the orc was going to kind of control the Panthers and the caster was going to be doing terrible things to us. Honestly, if you think about it, it was a full party.
Exactly. Yeah. And those essentially parties had like built-in tactics. They weren't written into the adventure as far as I could tell, but like the casters had hold person, which against a party of players, that's a really good option. The orc Beastmasters had the Panthers to put up front, and then they had bows. So like their tactic was, I'm going to send my Panther to engage with the front line, and I'm going to shoot at whoever looks vulnerable at the moment. Those tactics made a lot of sense. I believe most of those creatures likely didn't have super high intelligence. So like if we were sticking to the guidelines we've talked about in this episode, those creatures likely wouldn't have deviated far from those obvious tactics. Like the Panthers, they're Panthers. What are they going to do besides run up and pounce on things? The orc archers probably had decent wisdom. I believe the hobgoblins were clerics, so they probably had decent wisdom as well. And if the adventure wasn't written so that every single encounter was in a one-way room, they probably would have run away. But
yeah, although maybe you can make an argument, right? Because the hobgoblin boss came out later.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they were more afraid of the boss than they were, you know, essentially a dereliction of duty. All I know. I guess we didn't finish murdering them because the hobgoblin came out.
That does sound like a mess.
It was kind of a mess. Yeah. So let's talk about leaders in a group. So chances are if you've played a lot of tabletop RPGs, like you may be that experienced player, or like you may have been in your first couple of games, you had someone who was super experienced, and in a lot of cases that player was like, hey, I've been doing this for a while, let me offer some advice to the party. Take that into the game. The monsters might have someone in the party like, this is the smart guy with the training making the decisions, and we're muscle. So like you've got the five town guards with like 10 intelligence, 10 wisdom, and a spear each, and then you have like the guard sergeant who's been around the block a couple times, has slightly higher intelligence, they're proficient in better weapons, they know what they're doing a bit. So that character might be giving commands to the other creatures. So you can say, yes, the dumb creatures are relying on that leader to make better tactical decisions. So you can basically pretend every one of them has slightly better intelligence than they would otherwise. Like that leader, if the town guard needs to apprehend the party full of players, the leader might say, hey, go beat down the wizard first and then gang up on the fighter in the front once the wizard is down, because the fighter is not going to be able to bring us all down as quickly. But once that leader goes down, they're going to resort to those basic tactics of, I have pointy stick.
Yeah, and I think there are certain monsters that kind of work this way, have this in mechanics as well, like the Hobgoblin chief, I think it is, or whatever the leader of the Hobgoblin is, he can give as a reaction, he can give his minions a reaction attack, again, a free attack against another player. Or you could have your leaders give inspiration to their men, just as a way to show that they're, you know, making everybody more intelligent and working together better in addition to their tactic.
Yeah, those are great examples of like turning the concept into direct mechanics. Honestly, it's a little disappointing that there aren't more creatures like that across the whole CR range, because
I agree.
There are a lot of creatures that are conceptually at least designed to work together, like Ugaloths, the basically mercenary neutral evil fiends. They're functionally an interdimensional mercenary army. Like, they have specific tactics, they have a specific hierarchy, but none of the creature's stats actually give them any motivation to interact with each other in any meaningful way. Like, it's like they're all written to be a moderately interesting standalone creature. But you could very easily be like, ah, yes, the Arcanoloths, which are very, very smart and very wise and can cast spells. Like, that's going to be a war leader in a bunch of whatever the fighty Ugaloths are. And they're going to make the tactical decisions.
So what we really need is the folks at WotC, we need to get the Magic the Gathering people to go talk to the Dungeons and Dragons people, and then we'll probably start to get this.
Yes.
Perfect.
Build every encounter like a commander deck. I don't know if that's how that works. I haven't played Magic in years.
You're not wrong.
It's close enough. But it's like, I want an elf deck, right?
I feel like we had that discussion on the Discord recently and devolved into slivers for some reason.
Oh, sliver decks. Slivers
are really, really good. So, yeah.
Yeah. What's funny, I feel like we're all about at the right age where that is, you know, that was our prime peak Magic.
Yep.
Also, cool. I think we did it. So we have a question of the week this week. This week, our question of the week comes to us from @DesignNuts.
I think it's Dizzy Nuts.
Yeah, it's Dizzy Nuts.
We've had a question from Dizzy Nuts before, which we really enjoyed. So it's always great to hear from you again, Dizzy Nuts. Thank you.
I really
love the name.
I really hope he's sitting at home thinking it actually is Design Nuts. No, yeah. Anyway, what are the mechanics behind Burrow in 5e?
Well, they're probably simpler than you think. It's like flying, but down.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much. I'm kidding.
Yes, are you blind when you're burrowing?
You're not blind, but you can't see through solid objects generally. So a lot of creatures that have burrow speeds will have tremor sense or blind sense, which allows them to perceive around them. If you don't have those senses, you basically have to guess. So like, let's say you're a human and you get a burrow speed from a spell or a magic item or something, you can dig under the ground. There's a few things you can't do. You can't see because it's dark. You probably can't breathe because you're under a wall of dirt. And you probably can't tell how far down you are unless you've kept very careful track. So creatures without stuff like tremor sense very frequently need to like pop their heads back up and look around and figure out where they are. Also, generally with burrow, you won't be able to burrow through solid stone. So you can go through dirt, sand, gravel, things like that, but you couldn't like dig through a wall of granite or something like that.
I also think that if you're burrowing, you have full cover, essentially. Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So even if there is another creature underground with you with tremor sense, I would say that they probably can't target you with most things. So like, let's say you've got two clerics who are underground trying to shoot each other with sacred flame. They probably can't because they can't see each other. Now, it might get a little fuzzy when you've got two creatures in adjacent squares, and you might say like, they're close enough together that they're basically putting their hands on each other. Honestly, the rules don't get that specific on it because there aren't that many things that burrow, and they really haven't dug into what fighting looks like when everybody's burrowing.
Yeah.
So what are the creatures that have burrow, right? It's my wormlings.
Purple worms, badgers.
Purple worms. I believe white dragons have a burrow speed for some reason. I think they like to dig through snow or ice or something.
Weird.
Blets are probably the most famous burrowing creatures. And, you know, the land shark, quote unquote.
Yeah.
They'll pop out of the ground and leap up in the air and land on you. It's very silly. It's a very absurd creature.
I love them.
Yeah, I mean, just spot checking. It looks like brass dragons.
What?
Okay, sure. I don't know.
I just looked. It's true.
Sure. Okay.
Didn't Tarrasque have a burrow speed?
Not in any of the additions that I have played. Like, it's talked about in third edition having an underground lair somewhere, but it's never clear how it gets in and out of that lair. So either magic and it teleports somehow, or it's just got a really big cave.
Oh, okay. Actually, I feel like maybe when we were talking about how to get it to where your Trask couldn't be killed by a level 3 character hovering on a magic carpet, the answer was we give it a burrow speed and that fixes it. That's my confusion.
Yeah.
Apparently, frost druids also have burrow speed.
I want to see that.
Oh, as a fox. Got it.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, okay.
Also trolls. Desert trolls.
Desert trolls. Okay. Yeah, dig around in sand. That makes sense. Sure.
I mean, it's hot out there.
Yeah, druids are probably one of the easiest ways that players get access to a burrow speed. Just turn into something with a burrow speed, and there you go. Burrow does get a little bit silly, even if you pick a burrowing creature. Like, I'm going to turn into a mole, and the DM's going to give me a 5-foot burrow speed, which is absurdly fast to dig through the dirt, but it's also the smallest amount of speed you can give a creature in 5e.
It can also be annoying to fight against as a player if your DM uses it effectively. Like, if you have most people fight like the purple worm just out of the ground, but if you're playing it smart, you have him attack, then go back underground.
Yep.
Then wait, and then come back up and attack and go back underground.
And so again, Purple Worm doesn't have to be incredibly intelligent, because that is their one tactic.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I believe they have swallow holes, so if I were the Purple Worm, like, pop up, swallow something, run away.
Yep.
Now, Purple Worms famously leave a huge tunnel behind them that the players can chase them through, but other than that, there's not a lot the players can do.
Yeah. We'll put you at the chase mechanics.
Yeah. We talked about the benefits of laying prone in 5e, since it costs half your movement to stand up and nothing to lay prone. Burrowing into the ground is basically just an upgrade from that. Like, pop out on your turn, do mischief, burrow back into the ground.
Okay, I have a question. And we may have answered this in other context, but let's... the one mechanic that might matter here. I have a burrow speed, a fly speed, and a walking speed. I use half of my walking movement. Can I still burrow?
It depends. The rules for moving with multiple movement speeds in 5e are pretty specific. Basically, you count up the amount of movement you've used in total. As long as that amount has not exceeded your speed for whatever movement type, you can still use that speed. So let's say I have a 10-foot burrow speed, a 20-foot fly speed, and a 30-foot walking speed. So if I have moved 10 feet by any of those methods, I can no longer burrow. If I've moved 20 feet, I can't burrow, I can't fly. If I get to 30 feet, I've used up all of my movement. So, like, you could burrow 10 feet, fly 10 feet, walk 10 feet, and that's your full 30 feet of movement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All hail the Leisure Illuminati. I'm Randall James. You'll find me at amateurjack.com and on Twitter and Instagram at jackamateur.
I'm Tyler Campster. You'll find me at rpgbot.net, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at rpgbotdotnet, patreon.com/rpgbot, and Reddit's r/rpgbot.
And I'm Ash Eli. You can follow me on Twitter at Graven Ashes.
If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcast and rate us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. It's a quick free way to support the podcast and helps us to reach new listeners. You'll find links in the show notes. You'll find affiliate links for source books and other materials linked in the show notes, as well as on rpgbot.net. Following these links helps us to make this show happen every week. If your question should be the question of the week next week, please email podcast@rpgbot.net or message us on Twitter at rpgbotdotnet. Please also consider supporting us on Patreon, where you'll find ad-free podcast episodes, early access to rpgbot.net content, polls for future content, and access to the rpgbot.net Discord. You can find us at patreon.com/rpgbot. If you find, like, scat in the woods, you can tell it because it's piled. It kind of looks like human, but it's like 3 times the size of what you would expect to find. It has bells in it. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.